American taxpayers,
come on down. You're the next contestant on The Price is Right.
The Congress prepares to openly debate the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, putting war costs back into the budget. The Price is Right. Not a game show. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, Tuesday, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo. I'm John Hockenberry. I'm joined this morning by Farai Jadeh. Hey, Farai.
Hey, John. So coming up this hour, we're going to talk about that new wartime spending bill that you mentioned. We'll also discuss a new study on bullying. Young kids who are pushed around are more likely to develop psychotic symptoms as teens. And is having a bookish president making nerds cool? The Takeaway contributor Patrick Henry Bass gives us his take. Those stories coming up, but first these headlines.
Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili says a mutiny and an army base is an isolated case, and the situation is under control. That's Saakashvili. The government says it uncovered a Russian-supported plot to overthrow the government earlier today. Russia and Georgia clashed over borderlands last year. This comes ahead of NATO military exercises planned in Georgia tomorrow. The Pakistani government is urging residents of the country's volatile Swat Valley to evacuate. A peace deal with the Taliban, which controls the region, appears to be crumbling. The government says the Taliban is planning violent attacks and that the military may have to retaliate. This comes as Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari prepares to meet with President Obama in Washington tomorrow. Farai?
Now, meanwhile, the Afghan President Hamid Karzai is going to meet with President Obama this week. That comes as dozens of Afghan civilians died last night in a bombing by coalition aircraft. That is according to Afghan officials. The bombs, they say, were dropped on a Taliban-controlled region in the western part of Afghanistan after fighting broke out on the ground. The U.S. says it's investigating. Mexico is getting back on its feet after a five-day shutdown imposed to halt the spread of H1N1 or swine flu. Cafes, museums, and libraries all reopened this week, but official Cinco de Mayo celebrations were canceled. Meanwhile, dozens of Mexicans are being flown home from China on a specially chartered plane.
American journalist Roxana Sabiri will have her second day in court next week. An Iranian appeals court will hear her case next week. She was found guilty last month on charges of espionage. The U.S. says the charges are baseless and is calling for her release. President Obama meets with Israeli President Shimon Peres in Washington today. In coming weeks, he'll meet with new Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke will speak to Congress about the country's economic health. He's expected to field questions on how the big banks have fared on their stress tests. Official grades are due out on Thursday. The Dow rose 2.6% yesterday. It finished at 84.27. The S&P surged 3.4%, ending at 907. Excuse me. It is up for the year for the first time. Bullying is on our mind, folks, because it can cause negative effects on the brain. Literally, you'll learn about a new study later this hour. But what's your advice? The best way to stand up to a bully?
Hello, my name is Mara from New Jersey. I think about bullying. What you need is friends. As long as you have friends around, you will not be bullied.
If you have friends, you won't be bullied. What is your story? How to stand up to a bully at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email your story and suggestion, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Cinco de Mayo. Happy Cinco de Mayo, Farai.
Yes, how you doing?
I'm doing great. And we begin in Washington. There's a lot to talk about. And really, we start off with The Price is Right. That's the debate down in Washington today as House Democrats unveil a $94.2 billion wartime spending bill. It adds $9.3 billion to the White House request. This is the first time, or basically the last time, the war is dealt with all by itself. From now on, it's going to be in the budget. The Price is Right, hence the reference. Todd Zwillick joins us. He's the Takeaway Washington correspondent. We also want to talk about speculation regarding a Supreme Court nominee from Barack Obama and how that shakes out in the Senate. Todd, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning.
Let's talk about The Price is Right here, $94.2 billion. This is the last time the war will be a supplemental, and we are talking about Afghanistan and Iraq folded in together, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You remember, boy, year after year after year, the criticism, especially from Democrats, that the Republican administration and the Republican Congress were spending these tens upon hundreds of billions of dollars on Iraq and Afghanistan off budget in what's called emergency supplementals. Emergency supplementals are exactly what they sound like. They're emergencies, and the supplemental part means you don't have to budget for it, which means it's deficit spending.
Well, it's more like camouflage than an emergency.
It's all of those. Exactly. Sometimes things are an emergency, of course, and swine flu, for instance, could be deemed an emergency. There's money for swine flu in here. You know, the wars are an emergency in that you can't risk not funding them. On the other hand, Barack Obama was one of the very vocal critics of the last administration, saying you have to budget for this stuff because you got to get the money from somewhere, and accused the former administration of smoke and mirrors. So yes, this is the last time they're going to be doing the smoke and mirrors approach to war funding, and after this, making the hard choices of putting it in an already in a budget that already has, as we all know, ballooning deficits.
Right. So. One of the devilish details here regards Guantanamo and the relocation of prisoners. It appears that this funding request is part of a confrontation between the Obama administration and members of Congress about the way prisoners are being treated at Guantanamo.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, there was an original request of $80 million in the White House's war request for this plan that the president has, that we've all heard about, to close Guantanamo Bay and move the prisoners elsewhere. No more Gitmo. The problem from the perspective of members of Congress, one of the problems among several others, is that there apparently is no plan. There's just a statement that we're going to do it. Members, especially the powerful chairman of the Appropriations Committee, David Obey, said he wasn't really interested in spending $80 million on sort of an idea without any plan from the administration. That money is not in the House version of the war supplemental. What the Senate will do with it, we don't know yet. They haven't decided, and the appropriators there aren't really saying as of now. But the House is not putting that money in. The reaction to that yesterday was one of sort of disappointment on the part of some members and others saying, look, as soon as the administration comes up with a plan that we can sink our teeth into, we will find a way to get them the money. You know, Congress doesn't need an emergency supplemental to find $80 million. Well, they can pretty
Todd,
much.
Fry has a question here, but I just wanted, just before we leave this, are you saying that there is not consensus on closing Gitmo based on this dispute, or there is consensus, they just want more details?
There is consensus on closing Gitmo. There is not consensus on what to do after that. That's the plan I'm talking about. Where to put it, what to do with the prisoners, what will their status be, et cetera.
Understood.
And Todd, also just quickly, you know, one of the narratives that it strikes me is happening here is that there's more transparency about the budget on these war efforts. At the same time, there's also what's called the black budget, which is a lot of times for special ops and Rangers, Delta Force, et cetera, et cetera. Is that showing up? Do we have any idea if they're now going to be transparent about that or ish?
They are generally not transparent about those things, Farai, and I guess that's why they call it the black budget and black ops and all those other sort of pejorative names for it. The paper and the briefings that were put out yesterday were all of the unclassified, declassified and unclassified parts of war funding. Not only war funding, by the way, but let me mention civil society, infrastructure, all of there's a whole other side to this funding with Pakistan and Afghanistan. We might get into it later on this week as Karzai and what's his name again from Afghanistan? Pakistan.
Zardari.
I just forgot.
Zardari.
Thank you.
Zardari.
Like
thank
I didn't
you.
Know that.
I'll take South Asian leaders for 50.
thanks, John.
Let's move on to the Supreme Court for just a second because the prospect of the Senate having 60 votes has really changed the debate, and it has caused some senators up there on the Hill to worry about how a Supreme Court nomination is going to go. Here's Jeff Sessions, Alabama senator, who's just been chosen to replace Arlen Specter, who switched parties, to be the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Someone could say, well, how can you complain? You filibustered Alito. So you could have that argument made, I guess. To me, I think we should do the right thing on the process of giving judges a vote.
Open nervousness there, and here's Orrin Hatch talking about the same thing.
If he nominates somebody that's contrary to what he told me, I think there'd be a big pitch battle over it. But the Democrats do have enough votes on the committee to do just about anything they want to do. But that doesn't mean that there wouldn't be a pitched battle in the Senate.
A pitched battle in the Senate over a potentially ideological Supreme Court justice. Todd, stay put right there. We're going to ask you a couple of questions about those senators, but let's bring in Jeffrey Rosen, who's a professor of law at George Washington University and legal affairs editor of The New Republic. Jeffrey Rosen, you wouldn't oppose a strongly ideological replacement for Justice Souter, right?
Certainly not. Obama has pledged to appoint a good liberal who cares about the powerless rather than the powerful, and he wants the most effective liberal he can get, of course.
And as far as how that relates to the process, with the Democrats having at least potentially 60 votes, what does that contribute? What opportunity does this represent for Barack Obama in terms of having an influence on the court?
Well, in the crudest terms, he can't shift the court because, of course, a liberal will be replacing Justice Souter, and the balance of the court will remain the same with Justice Kennedy running the show. But it's a tremendous opportunity for him to make clear his constitutional vision. I mean, this is the issue he's thought more about and in some sense cares more about than any other, both as a constitutional law professor and on the campaign trail. He talked about how much he cares about the court. So the issue isn't will he get a good, reliable liberal. All the candidates on the short list are that. The question is what kind of liberal. What will the temperament be? How effective will the candidate be in not only challenging the conservatives, but persuading them in some cases? So it's something that he'll be advised a lot about, but in the end, this is a decision he'll make entirely on his own, and it'll tell us a lot about what he really thinks the Constitution should be.
Todd, I'm curious. There has been, obviously, there have been so many pitched battles over the Supreme Court at different points. Do we have any idea how Republicans are going to react or you know, maybe have a preemptive strike on any nominee?
Well, I don't think they've decided yet. I think that really depends on who is nominated and then what kind of case they think they can make. A senator like Jeff Sessions, who, as you said, John, is taking over the Judiciary Committee, he has been at the center of the so-called ideological pitched battles in the past. He is the reliable, rock-rib conservative who loves to fight Democrats on judicial nominations, and he's taking over that committee. Arlen Specter was a little bit less so, and he's now on the president's team. So we don't know how they're going to react, but they are going around yesterday in my interview there with Sessions and with Hatch saying they want... they understand that the president will probably appoint somebody who's more liberal than they would like, but they don't. They use the buzzword. Their buzzword is judicial activism. They don't want someone who they think makes law from the bench or injects their ideology from the bench to help causes or people that they're empathetic to. They want
right.
what they call a non ideological arbiter. Of course, if you're a conservative, you would say that for somebody
sure.
that Barack Obama is going to appoint. But that's what they're saying.
Jeffrey Rosen, in the few minutes that we have before we go, who is on the list of people? There's an enormous amount of lead time here, so we'll have a lot of time to consider who might be the nominee. Who are the people on the list who would satisfy you?
Well, they're all able. The top candidates include Sonia Sotomayor, who's a judge in New York, Elena Kagan, the U.S. Solicitor General, Diane Wood, who's a judge in Chicago. My personal favorite, for what it's worth, is not much. I think Elena Kagan really has a unique combination of intellectual dazzling firepower and also tremendous personal skills. She did such a good job at Harvard Law School in convincing not only liberals but conservatives to converge around common outcomes that I'm awfully impressed with her. But all of the names on the short list are good, and they present different trade-offs, and Obama's going to have a lot to think about.
What do you make of the Times suggestion over the weekend? It was on the front page that this court is pretty narrow. They're all judges. They're all coming from the federal circuit, and that to stay with that would further narrow the court.
There's a lot to it, and indeed on the campaign trail, Obama said that his model was Earl Warren, the former governor of California, because Warren understood in Brown v. Board of Education, which struck down segregation, the effects of segregation on real kids rather than its abstract effects.
Right.
It's disappointing in that sense to see so few politicians on the list.
Well, there's still time. Some reports say we might get a name from the president to replace Justice Souter as soon as the end of the week. Thanks to Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University, editor of The New Republic on legal affairs, and, of course, Todd Zwillick in Washington. Thanks to both of you. And excuse me, I mean, what's going on? I'm, like, strangling.
Feel better.
Yeah, thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And today we're thinking about bullying because a new study says bullying victims are more likely to develop psychotic symptoms as teens. We and kids need your advice. What's the best way to stand up to a bully? Maybe you have your own story to share when you or your child did that.
Hi, I'm Noam from New York, New York. And I just say shut up and get a life to the bullies if they bully me.
Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake at thetakeaway.org. John?
I love that. So last month when Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, gave President Obama a gift, it made headlines all over the world.
I think it was a nice gesture to give me a book. I'm a reader.
But it wasn't just diplomatic headlines. It was all cultural as well. We have a bookish president. We know that. He's a reader. But Barack Obama is also a character, striding through a narrative arc of African-American culture, male culture, and literary culture. Suddenly, maybe, African-American nerdy characters like this aren't so funny anymore.
Hi, Eddie.
Urkel, thank goodness you're here. I'm flunking algebra and I need you to tutor me.
Well, this is my busy season. I'm trying to teach the football team fractions.
Steve, I'm desperate. If you don't help me, I can't go to the Prince concert. Check out these seats.
Third row! Wow, you could get sweated on!
Does Obama trump Urkel, Steve Urkel, the character in Family Matters who teaches the football team fractions? Suddenly, that's a virtuous mission. And here to talk about it and Barack Obama's impact on all of these characters, it's an interesting, nuanced story. And we're thrilled to have Takeaway contributor Patrick Henry Bass here. Patrick, this is a fascinating story that you turned us on to. What's going on? Does Barack Obama destroy Urkel?
Well, who can beat Urkel? I don't think anyone can. But in the 15 years I've covered publishing, I've never seen three titles by African-American male authors, smart authors, you know, coming down the pipeline. We have, first of all, Colson White has Sag Harbor, which is already getting great buzz. Then we have Victor LaValle's Big Machine, and that's going to be followed by David Anthony Durham's book, The Other Lands, which is almost like if they're fans of Dungeons and Dragons. And so the fact that you have these three smart African-American authors who have been marginalized in many ways because they didn't have, you know, large fans. You know, Colson Whitehead was largely supported by the literati. Victor LaValle, very, very small audience. David Anthony Durham tried historical fiction. Then he started doing the Acacia series. Not big audiences. And now we have the opportunity to have a serious conversation about African-American authors who are defying categorization in terms of their writing.
How is this different from, say, Bill Clinton being a fan of Walter Mosley, who is a mystery author, of course, and suddenly his sales spiked back in the 90s?
Well, it was the fact that Bill Clinton liked Walter Mosley, but that was about it. That's all he really talked about in terms of writing and reading. With Barack Obama, we get the sense that this is someone who takes reading very seriously. He wants to open up dialogues at the White House to invite writers and thinkers to come to the White House, spoken word poets. This has been a part of who he's been all his life. So it was almost with Bill Clinton, I saw that as political to say that I like an African-American Jewish mystery writer. I saw it as political. I think that that's sort of natural when it comes to Barack Obama.
You know, one thing that strikes me batting for the girls team is that there's also a bunch of female writers who are reshaping blackness, like Stacey Ann Chin, who has, you know, she's one of the deaf poets and who has a memoir of being, you know, Afro-Chinese, Jamaican, and a lesbian. So, you know, and an intellectual. And so it strikes me that, you know, the intellectualism is really something, you know, there's all these critiques of black culture that we're anti-intellectual. Do you think we're getting over it?
Well, I hear you about Stacey Ann Chin. The challenge is that we only will have one African-American male smart writer. We had Trey Ellis with Platitudes, you know. Then there were many years that passed by. Then we had John Ridley with his noir series. Then we had Matt Johnson with Drop. We had Paul Beatty with The White Boy Shuffle. So it almost it's almost as if these guys are aliens. They're not. I mean, they exist among us. I think, you know, I know these guys. You know, I know guys right. like them. In many ways, I have my inner nerd.
Well, we should say that all these titles and all these authors are going to be on our website. So if you want to go and sort of check out what Patrick is talking about here and some of these authors. Here's Colson Whitehead in a New York Times podcast discussing his own black experience. I have a question. Listen to this and let's get a reaction.
We were black kids with beach houses, and we didn't understand that the world would find us strange, and so we had to figure out our own sort of path. My grandparents' generation were serious strivers and sort of inventing the black middle class. My mother and her generation inherit that and try to take it further. And my generation, growing up in the post-civil rights movement, we're sort of trying to find our own sort of identity.
Is this an intellectual emergence or a class emergence of a privileged black middle class?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, Colson Whitehead writes about, you know, the African-American elite and Sag Harbor, but he's clearly a misfit. Benji, the character, is a 15-year-old who loves ABBA. You know, I mean, he's just not a cool kid. And what I love about the narrative, the narrative in Sag Harbor is, for once, the black guy wins. The smart black guy wins. The smart black guy has always been sort of an oddity. In those John Hughes movies, we never saw him. In Pretty in Pink, he never existed. You know, that kid was always sort of, you know, just sidelined. He was just an extra in those movies. Now they're taking center stage. I think in large part, we can have a serious conversation about this type of literature because of the presence of Barack Obama.
Well,
for the 21 months that he campaigned, we saw the skinny kid with the big ears and the funny name that America had to embrace. Urkel was just a character on a sitcom, 30 minutes on Friday nights. Barack Obama is a presence every day of our lives.
Wither Boys in the Hood, then. I mean, there's strong African.
It's a film. It's different from literature. It's a film.
Well, one of the things that also strikes me is that there is a moment in time right now where black audiences and white audiences and, you know, non-black, non-white audiences are merging sometimes. But do you think black folks are really reading Whitehead's novel?
Well, that's what I think is a great opportunity with the presence of Barack Obama. I think that Sag Harbor is now going to appeal to African-American audiences that may have resisted books that Colson Whitehead did, like John Henry Days and Apex Hides the Hurt in his first book, The Intuitionist, about an elevator inspector. I think that Victor LaValle's Big Machine, which is about cults and, you know, it's almost Saul Bellow-esque, I think that he's also going to appeal to African-American readers who may have resisted some of his earlier work.
What's one book for our listeners to be introduced to exactly what you're talking about?
I think Platitudes by Trey Ellis.
Takeaway contributor Patrick Henry Bass talking about the phenomena of Barack Obama in letters and particularly male African-American authors. You can find the titles we talked about all on our website, takeaway.org. Thanks for joining us, Patrick. And now Femi Oke has some quick headlines.
At 29 minutes past the hour, the nation of Georgia accuses Russia of backing a military coup. Russia denies it. The Georgian government says it's aware of a plot to overthrow the government. It says it now has the troop mutiny under control near its capital. An American journalist held prisoner in Iran will have an appeal next week. Iran's judiciary released the news today about Roxana Zuberi. The reporter got an 8-year sentence for a spying conviction. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke testifies on the Hill today. He is taking questions from lawmakers as some positive economic signs are beginning to appear. Let's look at some headlines making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea. We're talking about bullying. Is it a big deal?
This is Joe calling from Baltimore. I had a guy that bullied me, that lived up the street from me for, you know, maybe 2-3 years. He did things like pushing me down in the snow and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I look back on those days now and I laugh. I've seen him since we've been grown up, and you know, I don't think it's turned either of us into this bitter person that's still harboring ill feelings about things that happened when we were children.
Very, very healthy. And we are asking for your stories of how to deal with bullies at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I have to say, I think we've been getting some great stories.
Great stuff, yeah.
But in a somewhat disconcerting new study, scientists report that young kids who are bullied by other kids are more likely to develop psychotic symptoms as teens. Over 6,000 children were in the study. They were followed from ages 8 to 13. That research is just out yesterday in the May issue of the journal Archives of General Psychiatry. And here to tell us more, we're joined by Dieter Volker. He's a professor of developmental psychology and individual differences at the University of Warwick, and he joins us from England. So thanks for coming on. You know, I'm not a parent, but if I were, I'd be really scared by this because bullying is hardly uncommon. So, you know, really, what are we talking about when you say bullying?
Well, when we talk about bullying, it's really victimization that's repeated, systematic, and an abuse of power. And you've got two types of bullying. The one is direct bullying, like, for example, threats or being hit, beaten, etc. And you have got relational bullying, which are things like being excluded from the group, like, you're not my friend, you can't play with us, etc. It's very important to distinguish this, what we call bullying, which is repeated every week, from conflicts that occur between children of the same strengths and ability.
Now, a few weeks ago, there was this shocking story about an 11-year-old Carl Walker who hanged himself, apparently, after being bullied at school. And this was in Springfield, Massachusetts. Here's a little bit of his mother, Sir Dina Walker.
Any parent out there, they have to do whatever is necessary to protect their child.
So what does that mean? What is by any means necessary when it comes to protecting your child?
Well, these are really two things. I mean, there's a role for parents. I think what is very important is that bullying very often can start at home. I mean, we have done in a different study, we looked at sibling bullying, and it is clear that children who are victimized basically by their older brother or older sister are also more likely to be victimized by their peers. And for parents, it's important not to be permissive, but to be very clear, loving, and supporting, but also set very clear rules and identify who's the perpetrator and have adequate punishment for it so that the children actually learn the rules. But it doesn't stop there. Parents can't sit in the school and look after their children all the time. So it's very important that schools have good policies integrated in their curriculum, and in particular also have good supervision, like in the playground, be fair, and things like peer befriending schemes where the peers are actually themselves helping, because children are more likely to turn to another older child than telling the parents or the teacher.
How do you distinguish between sort of rivalry and bullying? I mean, in some sense, I think I know what bullying is, but, you know, I have four kids, and you know, my son's older sisters love to play with him and make him play the dog in their games. Should I be concerned about that?
No, you shouldn't be, because that's role-playing, and they're actually fitting in. And the important thing is if the younger one actually has got fun, then that's perfectly fine. What we're talking about is a child who really doesn't want to be teased on, doesn't want to be picked on, doesn't want to be beaten, doesn't have any way to fight back, and feels victimized and tries to avoid the situation. It then shows that they don't want to be with the other kids, stay away from others, don't have any friends who help them. So your situation, which you're describing, is a normal trying to find out different roles rather than being victimized.
Is it possible that children display symptoms, pre-psychotic symptoms, and that attracts bullies to them, and that you're observing a phenomenon that goes back before the bullying itself?
Yeah, that's perfectly possible. It's called reverse causality. Now, one of the things is really before 8 years of age, you can't measure psychotic symptoms, because then a lot of children who believe in Santa Claus, fairies, or think that they're Batman would have delusions. It's a normal part of their development. However, it's pretty clear how bullies work is that they try to pick, if they're in a class and come in a new classroom, they pick on every child. And then they home in on the child that shows the reaction, like, for example, cries, runs away, and has very little support. So the children have less social skills, they very often are alone, don't have any friends who stand up for them, and show a very strong reaction. And that's where bullies home in. So there's some social skill deficit which they're more try to tune in. But it's very important. This is not blaming the victim. We should do something to strengthen these children. But that's one of the things that has been observed.
It sounds to me like this may have some link to PTSD, you know, post-traumatic stress, and how people react and do sometimes after, you know, anything from a violent incident to participating in a war. Just change. Can you change these kids back after they have had this psychotic break?
Yes, there are a number of studies who have tried to do intervention studies. I mean, there's not one recipe. But one of the things is very important that these children feel integrated, that they can make friends or they have got support, like by a peer support network. Another work we have just completed, which is an intervention study to use virtual reality, because children find it very difficult. You see, teachers often do role play, etc., in the classroom, and often it actually leads that the child gets victimized again in this role play or picked on. So what they could do is something like a role play by virtual reality, and could give advice to children who are agents on a computer screen of how they can escape victimization. We found over a four-week period that half of the children were previous victims actually escaped being victims because they learned social skills really in privacy. So there are some ways of doing this.
Well, thanks so much. We've been speaking with Dieter Voca, PhD, professor of psychology at the University of Warwick. And now we have Femi Oke with the headlines.
Thank you. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Israeli President Shimon Peres meets with President Obama today. The most powerful post in Israel's political system is held by the prime minister. And the new man in the job is Benjamin Netanyahu. He doesn't meet with President Obama until later this month. The Boston Globe has worked out new deals with all the unions but one. But that one is the largest union at the newspaper, so its future is still in doubt. Both sides say that they'll be back at the negotiating table, but talks are stalled over a job guarantee program. The Globe shares a parent company with the Takeaway's partners at the New York Times. A diplomatic scuffle between Mexico and China is now playing out in the skies. It's over H1N1, or swine flu. Both countries have sent chartered planes to the other to bring their citizens home. Mexico took flight first, saying that China was unfairly quarantining Mexicans who were not sick. And that's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Billions and billions served that McDonald's credo could just as easily apply to the population load on our planet. You might have heard people crunch the numbers and say, you know, just for example, Muslims are having far more babies than Europeans, and in the coming years, way more Chinese babies will be born than ones in the U.S. That might betray a little bit of insecurity about America's place in the world, but Martin Walker says we should take a closer look at how we keep tabs on the global population. He's a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and he's got a new article in the Wilson Quarterly on the topic. So, Martin, can you tell us about some of the myths about population?
Well, I think one of the greatest myths is one that the Europeans have stopped breeding, and that they're going to be increasingly dominated by a large immigrant population from North Africa and from the Middle East, and as one American scholar put it, grand cathedrals will appear as vestiges of a prior civilization, that Notre Dame in Paris and St. Paul's in London will be turned into mosques. And there's an awful lot of anecdotal evidence to support this. For example, the Times of London reported that among newborn baby boys' names, the name Mohammed had now become the second most popular after Jack, and had squeezed Thomas into third place. And you get this kind of this kind of figure, this kind of story, feeding into some right-wing politics, some anti-immigration politics, and so on. But if you actually look at the numbers, it's really not happening. The most dramatic, I think, finding that's coming out of the most recent studies that we've seen through the World Population Report for the United Nations is that Islamic birth rates around the world, in Europe and in the Middle East and in Asia, have pretty much dropped off a cliff. It's really remarkable the way that in about 1.5 to 2 generations, whether you look at Britain, whether you look at the Netherlands, whether you look at Germany, you see that immigrant women, no matter where they come from, whether from Africa or from the Middle East, their birth rates drop to the local norm very, very quickly, normally within about a couple of generations.
Well,
we've already seen, for example, that Turkish-born women in the Netherlands, they've got a birth rate below replacement level.
All right. Well, we only have a little more time, unfortunately, but what about the whole China birth rate issue?
Oh, well, China has had 30 years of the one-child policy, which has reduced their birth rate. But worse than that, because of the ability to check the sex of the child before birth, there's been a huge amount of abortion of female fetuses. The result is that there's going to be tens of millions, some people say as many as 100 million, young Chinese males who will never find a mate. But this is a phenomenon we're starting to see elsewhere in Asia, in India and so on as well. But we already know, for example, from the babies born already, that by 2020, there will be about 100 million more Indian teenagers than Chinese teenagers. And it looks at the moment on current trends that by about 2047, there could be more American babies born than Chinese babies.
Just one tiny, tiny word. America. Population healthy? Growing too much? Growing too little? Quickly?
Well, it depends what kind of society you want and what kind of birth rate you can afford. But it looks like America is going to be 430, 450 million by mid-century. That's half as big again as today.
Oh, Martin Walker, thanks so much. Senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We were talking about bullying just a moment ago. It affects the mind in addition to causing all kinds of detrimental behavioral effects. Kids and all of us need your advice. What's the best way to stand up to a bully? Lisa emails us, "I've learned to speak up about it and call the bully on the spot the moment I see it, whether it's perpetrated against me or someone else. Like the dog who soils the carpet," Lisa emails. "However, you've got to discipline them immediately in the act or they just don't get it. Surprisingly, even bullies don't like to hear they're disliked or unpopular." Call us with your story and bullying solutions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi Oke has the headlines now.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour is the time. The American cargo ship captain held hostage by Somali pirates is returning to Capitol Hill. Maersk Alabama captain Richard Phillips is scheduled to appear at a Senate hearing looking into what the U.S. can do to hold off pirate attacks. In Detroit, voters are heading out to the polls to elect a new mayor. It's a runoff election between incumbent Ken Cockrell Jr. and former pro basketball player Dave Bing. The winner will complete the last 7.5 months of ousted mayor Kwame Kilpatrick's second term. Kilpatrick stepped down in September after admitting he lied during a civil trial to cover up an affair with his chief of staff. Georgia's president says that a mutiny at an army base is an isolated case and the situation is under control. The government says it uncovered a Russian-supported plot to overthrow the government earlier today. Russia and Georgia clashed over borderlands last year, and this comes ahead of NATO's military exercise planned in the country of Georgia tomorrow. That's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
And the Boston Globe is 137 years old, but despite its long and storied history, it is in deep, deep trouble. Its owner, our partner, the New York Times Company, has threatened to shut down the paper unless the Globe agrees to $20 million in cost cuts. Talks with the Globe's largest union, the Boston Newspaper Guild, are set to resume today at 11 a.m. Now, the Globe is the highest-selling paper in New England, 14th largest newspaper in the U.S., but we want to discuss whether it could close or be radically altered. Emily Rooney's with us from our partner station WGBH in Boston. She hosts two shows, the news program Greater Boston and the weekly media criticism show Beat the Press. We've also got two devoted Boston Globe readers, David Williams of Brookline and Catherine Bumpus of Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And I want to thank you all for joining us. Now, Emily, the Globe could lose $85 million this year. That's massive. What's the latest news on the negotiations and what both parties want?
Well, starting with that figure, that $85 million figure, that is a figure that has been tossed out by the New York Times. And that paper has been completely unaccountable for that figure. You know, they've tossed it out. They've said that the unions had to come up with $20 million. $20 million doesn't cover $85 million. So they have been absolutely untransparent about this. They have not, you know, come forward, even in today's New York Times. All they did was report what happened yesterday, frankly. Those talks broke off at 6:45 a.m. Today, they're supposed to resume at 11 o'clock. The Guild says they've already come up with the $10 million that union alone needs to come up with. But frankly, it isn't enough because last week, the New York Times came forward and said, oh, we made a mistake. We miscounted the number of people who had already taken a buyout, and they don't factor in, so we're going to have to ask more from you. The union said, well, then we should start over with the negotiations. The Times refused to do that and basically held to the deadline.
Is there any sense, I mean, the newspaper industry, you have people like Walter Isaacson, the former editor of Time magazine, writing about content and how people can pay for content and giving away content, and some people are blaming the internet for completely undermining the newspaper model. What do you think the options are, not in the case of negotiations, but in the case of profitability for the Globe?
Well, if you read what Warren Buffett said yesterday at that conference, he says, I would never buy a newspaper. That's because you can get it for free. But a lot of people, including Stephen Brill of American Lawyers Weekly and a few others, have said there has got to be a model. We've got to change this in midstream. There's got to be a way to pay for content. It's still valuable. People still like to get sifted information, is what I call it. You don't want the internet is still, to some degree, the wild, wild west. You're never really sure exactly where the information is coming from. People like an editor, and that's why they read the Boston Globe, the New York Times, any newspaper. That's why.
Well, we've got Daniel E. Williams of Brookline. How are you doing?
Good. It's actually David Williams, so I'm doing fine.
I'm sorry about that. Now, tell me a little bit about your relationship to the paper. Do you see that being important in your life?
That's very important. I've gotten the Globe delivered to my door probably every day for the last 20 years, and I'd really miss it if it didn't arrive.
Do you think that it's, aside from your love for it, do you think that it can survive with the current audience?
I hope so. I mean, we were hearing before from Emily about how you can get things for free, and that's part of the problem. I think there's a lot of people that would consider themselves big supporters of the Globe and hope it doesn't close, and yet they don't subscribe to it. They read it for free online, and why not?
We've also got with us Catherine Bumpus of Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And Catherine, how do you consume the news? I mean, are you consuming the paper at all? If so, online, in paper form?
No, I subscribe to the Globe. I think we're a slightly unusual family. We subscribe to three papers here, the Cape Cod Times, the local Falmouth Enterprise, and the Boston Globe. I get them all delivered. We've always enjoyed it that way. I don't find reading the Globe online, though I do from time to time when I'm out of town, is the same experience. I like to be able to sit in the morning with my breakfast and take that time to read the paper and also to share it with my children. We were talking about this last night at dinner, and my children said they would be happy if just the G came to the door, which is the magazine section of the paper, because it's something they enjoy. And to be able to hand them something new to read every morning is really wonderful.
Now, Emily, let me go back to you. We've got two fans of the newspaper here. There are many reasons that people don't consume newspapers. Sometimes it's because they get other information for free. But particularly among poor and working class communities in cities across America, there's this complaint, well, you never came to our neighborhood to report on us anyway. How does the Globe stack up on that count?
The Globe does a terrific job covering all neighborhoods. They've had to cut back like a lot of other papers. But honestly, people who tell me that they don't read the newspaper because they think there's a liberal bias or they don't cover their community, I say, you don't read the newspaper because you don't want to. You don't read the newspaper and you are not informed. And, you know, this is just the fact of the matter. I mean, I gave it up because there's nothing in it for me.
Well, but
you
there's
gave
also,
it up because you don't want to.
Well, but the don't want to is not simply a
they can't afford it.
Well, it's not about trying to be ignorant. Maybe everyone doesn't have the experience, the time in the morning to share a newspaper with their children, and so the information comes to them in a fundamentally different way. If the newspaper is dependent on certain very specific practices and behaviors, then the business model is doomed, it seems to me.
Well, certainly,
the business model is doomed. I'm not disputing that.
But well, certainly I've known people who commuted on the T every day who read the paper on their commute. That's harder to do with a laptop in your lap if you're on public transportation most of the time. So the fact that that's the way I enjoy the paper doesn't mean that that's the way the vast majority of people enjoy the paper.
The T, of course, being the subway in Boston, which I've written many times. David, there's now talk that there'll be a new version of the Kindle, which is the electronic text reader that will be designed bigger so that you can read the newspaper. Is that yet another nail in the coffin of paper newspapers?
Well, not necessarily. I understand that some of these alternatives to the Kindle, the idea is that they'll actually be able to support advertising. So there's some hope that that will work. But that will probably be a little bit more like the websites where there's some advertising, but it doesn't come up with it. And I think it will be actually not just about reading the paper, but Boston will be a poorer place if the Globe isn't around. And we have a lot of powerful institutions in Boston and Massachusetts more generally, and there's really no natural watchdog for them other than the Boston Globe. And I think if the Globe weren't around, a lot of scandals would never be exposed, and also people in power would probably, you know, not think twice about doing things that they now do think twice about because they know the Globe might be after them.
Well, we have to wrap this up, but great stuff, David, Catherine, Emily. We've been speaking with two readers, David Williams of Brookline, Catherine Bumpus of Woodhull, and also journalist Emily Rooney. Thanks all.
So bullying is on our minds. We've been talking about it this hour. We need your advice. What's the best way to stand up to a bully? And maybe you have your own story to share when you or your child actually did that. Here's what Mimi in Michigan tells us.
When I was a child, I was actually a bully to a little girl, and I'll never forget a teacher pulling me and a couple other of my classmates who had been bullying out of the school play. We weren't allowed to participate, and it's lived on with me to where I am very cognizant of my children, schoolmates, the ones who are possibly bullied, and bringing that to light.
Tim emails us a similar story. I grew up in a violent household and I was a bully myself. In that day, you could abuse your own children. My sixth grade teacher suggested to my parents to place me in a foster home to get me out of there. My mother said yes. My father said no. Six more years of abuse followed. I moved and have struggled since. Your story is at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed any part of the show, particularly our discussion with Dieter Volka from the University of Warwick on the brain effects of bullying, take our podcast to go. You can subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Huckaberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Voting your way out of a crisis.
Yes, we've almost lost Detroit this time.
Detroiters may feel like they almost lost their city during the troubled times of Kwame Kilpatrick. Today, Detroiters go to the polls to select a successor to their convicted, disgraced former mayor. With everything else going on in Motown, can City Hall even help?
That time, say, well, almost lost Detroit.
Don't worry, we'll find it on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, May 5th. I'm John Hockenberry, and I'm joined this morning by Farai Chidea. Hi, Farai.
Hi, John. So coming up this hour, we're going to look ahead at Afghan President Hamid Karzai's week in Washington. He arrives today. Etiquette and ethics in the era of H1N1 virus. That's the swine flu, as people say. Can you even shake hands? We'll check in with the New York Times ethicist to find out do's and don'ts. And it's been a tough week for pork, so we're coming up with some marketing ideas to help it bounce back. These stories coming up, but first the headlines.
Pakistani officials say up to 500,000 people may end up fleeing the country's northwest Swat Valley. They're preparing camps to accommodate them. The government is urging people to leave after signs that a peace deal with the Taliban is turning sour. The government gave control of the region to the Taliban last month on the condition of disarmament. The Taliban say they will not lay down arms until Sharia law is fully implemented in Swat. In Afghanistan, the government says dozens of civilians were killed last night in bombing by coalition aircraft. The bombs were dropped on a Taliban-controlled region in the western part of Afghanistan after fighting broke out on the ground. The U.S. says it is investigating the report. More in a moment. Farai?
And first, the president meets with Israeli President Shimon Peres. That's today in the first of several key meetings with Middle Eastern leaders. Meetings with new Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas are scheduled for the coming week. And the Georgian government says a mutiny at a military base near Tbilisi is over. It announced today the discovery of a Russian-supported coup to kill the Georgian president. Russia and Georgia clashed over borderlands last year. This comes ahead of NATO military exercises planned in Georgia tomorrow. Now, meanwhile, opposition protests calling for the resignation of the president are continuing. And an Iranian appeals court will hear the case of American journalist Roxana Sabiri next week. She was sentenced to 8 years in prison after a one-day trial on charges of espionage, and the U.S. says the charges are baseless and they're calling for her release.
Wall Street seems to be headed for a down opening this morning, according to the futures trading, but that was after a banner day yesterday. The index is now, the S&P index is now up 0.4% for 2009, erasing its losses. We're thinking about bullying today because a new study says bullying victims are more likely to develop psychotic symptoms as teens. Find out more on our website. But we need your advice. What's the best way to stand up to a bully? Do you have any ideas?
I'm Jim from Providence, Rhode Island. I was a mental health counselor, and I found that genuine, derisive laughter helped stop verbal bullying.
Laughing your way in the face of bullies. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email your anti-bullying strategy at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. This is John Hockenberry. We begin in Afghanistan and Washington as Afghan President Hamid Karzai arrives in Washington for a meeting tomorrow with President Obama. Afghan officials say dozens of civilians died last night in bombings by coalition aircraft targeted against Taliban-controlled areas in the western part of Afghanistan. The U.S. is investigating the report. President Karzai has a credibility problem as he arrives in Washington. In fact, one of our listeners had a musical suggestion for the embattled Afghan president recently.
My name is Mike. My dedication would be for Hamid Karzai, Giving Shelter by the Rolling Stones.
So, how much shelter, if any, is the Afghan president likely to get as he comes to Washington? It's a question for Ambassador Robert Finn, the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban in 2002. He currently has a dual appointment in Princeton's Department of Near Eastern Studies and the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Ambassador, thanks so much for being a part of The Takeaway.
Good morning.
What is the challenge, first of all, for American diplomats attempting to affect changes within Afghanistan, dealing with Hamid Karzai, who even people on the ground in Afghanistan view as a weak, possibly discredited leader?
Well, there are a couple of things that haven't been done. The president's plan is heavier on the military side than the civilian side. I think the civilian side needs to be beefed up. The money has to be put up front, and the civilians have to be brought in there. And the reason for that is to help with governance and development in the country, because one of the major complaints of the people there, aside from security, and we've just had another incidence of those problems, is the fact that they don't see development. And this is a really weak side of the Karzai government. There has not been a trained civil service. There are not responsible government officials in the provinces. And that's an area where we could step in and be very visible. And I think we should do that. I tried to get this done when I was there. It didn't happen. I would suggest now, as part of the new program, setting up model provinces and taking over one or two provinces and working very closely with the governor there, perhaps in the province of Bamiyan, where there's a lady governor, to give a model for the people of what government in Afghanistan could be like.
Yet before he left for Washington, Karzai yesterday chose controversial warlord Mohammed Fahim to be one of his vice presidential running mates. It seems that part of Karzai's problems is that he deals not with civilian leaders who are creditable, as you say, but more like warlords, and that has been, behind his charge of being corrupt. Is he the leader for this new civilian leadership to be built up to counter the military?
We had to work with the government of Afghanistan, whoever that's going to be. They're going to have an election in August. I don't think the U.S. government should pick somebody to win before the election takes place. Marshal Fahim is one of the main warlords. You're quite right. He was also a minister of defense in the years when I was there. Karzai chose him simply for ethnic coloring so that he has a balanced platform. His other nominee for vice president is Khalili, who's leader of the Hazaras. So he chose him because of election balancing for the program. He will be a problem.
Yet, Hamid Karzai, from his moment of real triumph after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and the ouster of the Taliban, has eroded from this kind of popular civilian leader to someone who's barely the mayor of Kabul. Geographically speaking, what can Karzai hope to control in his own country?
Well, it's a more nebulous system than it looks like. He needs to have a government that's responsible to him that he can control. So he needs to have responsible government officials. He needs to be able to pay them a living wage, which we're still not doing in many cases, so that his government can reach out into the countryside. The people who are the government officials in the countryside now are appointed by him. They are all nominally subject to him, and in fact, they don't openly flout his authority. They just do it in their day-to-day basis. So this is something that could be worked on to aggrandize the power of the government, and it doesn't have to be Karzai. It can be someone else.
Let's talk about that. Do you expect the Obama administration to approach Karzai as one of many possibilities as the election gears up, or should they back Karzai as the person they're going to go with here?
I think for Afghanistan and for our relations with Afghanistan, the United States should not be supporting a particular candidate. Karzai, as you pointed out, is tarnished. There are some other candidates. I don't know who's going to win, but Afghanistan has to choose its own leader and not have someone outside telling them what to do.
How much of a challenge as an ambassador is it to deal with someone like Hamid Karzai, who has very little credibility on the ground, yet is sort of the ace in the hole for the administration, which has so much at stake inside Afghanistan?
Well, I certainly worked with a lot worse than Hamid Karzai in my career as ambassador, I can tell you that. At the time when I was there, he, in fact, was Mr. Afghanistan. He was very popular. Things seemed to be going well. So the problems that we have now, which I foresaw then, because after the bond program was implemented and he had to run the country, I saw that he would have problems with his management style and decisiveness and getting all of these truculent people in line. He is still someone we can work with. He is a problem. The real problem, as we see also in today's headlines, is the growing war. The Pakistani government is calling on the people of Swat to evacuate that valley. That's a very, very serious problem.
Ambassador, there has been much talk that the war in Iraq actually could be much simpler than Afghanistan, where the Taliban is just so deeply entrenched. What realistically when we talk about the Taliban, when we talk about the tensions in Afghanistan between the government and the Taliban, is this an uphill battle that really almost is not winnable?
No, it's a guerrilla war, and all Pashtuns are not Taliban. There are a lot of people who could be brought over to the government side. If the government could demonstrate security and development, and it's demonstrated security in certain areas, is yet to demonstrate convincing development for the people there. Many of the people who are fighting with the Taliban are fighting because the Taliban pays them better than anything else that's available. That can be changed.
Is that an argument for civilian aid? And is the civilian government robust enough to appropriately distribute aid to compete with the Taliban?
It is an argument for aid. Our expenditures in Afghanistan have been 94% military from the beginning. The government of Afghanistan will have problems in distributing the aid. And another area where we've fallen down is that we have not worked sufficiently to build up the capacity of the government of Afghanistan from the beginning. That's something that can be done. That's why I come back again to training a civilian capacity, our civilian capacity and their civilian capacity, because this is the weak pillar of the structure.
Let's shift over to military for a moment. I mean, what do you make of the story in the New York Times today? Jane Perlez writes that the porous border between Afghanistan and Pakistan actually makes NATO and coalition troops much more vulnerable, and that the war is going to be much worse rather than better, regardless of the amount of aid, simply because tactically the Taliban can run across the border and escape NATO forces.
She's absolutely correct, and I assume that they will be talking about that today, tomorrow when they have their meetings.
And is that why Karzai and Zardari are meeting together with Obama, that Obama needs to have both of them around the table to even get anything done?
I think it's good to have them both around the table. I don't know that it has to be exactly as you expressed it, but clearly the plan is to bring them all together to get some agreement on this. They have a mutual border that they have to defend. The government of Pakistan is, as we know, very weak. All of these things should be brought together and discussed together to work out a credible plan, because otherwise it's not going to turn out the way we want.
There's been a lot of talk about how aid groups are having a lot of difficulty in the region. And in some places like Sudan, aid groups, NGOs have really pushed for change. Do you see that with the NGOs who are operating in and around the region?
Well, yes, they are pushing for change. That's one of the reasons they're there. They're also seen by the Taliban as instruments of the Western military structures that are there. And this is a change from when the Taliban were in power, when they were seen as innocent people helping an Islamic State. And that's something that the NGOs have problems dealing with. But, yes, they are instruments of change. And one of the problems of the Pashtuns, not the Taliban's, is that they see their way of life threatened by what's going on. Modernism is coming to them, and Taliban is one answer that they've come up with for that. But it certainly doesn't have to be the only answer.
Well, a culture war in addition to a shooting war, they're complicating discussions as Hamid Karzai comes to Washington to meet with Barack Obama. Ambassador Robert Finn was the first U.S. envoy to Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban in 2002. He currently has a dual appointment in Princeton's Department of Near Eastern Studies and the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. He joined us from Princeton. Ambassador, thanks so much for being on the program.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We're talking about bullying this morning because a new study says bullying victims could have serious psychological consequences as teens. What's the best way to stand up to a bully?
Had to deal with that when I was a kid, and my dad told me the stories about his childhood heroes, guys like Jack Benny and George Burns that came up on way meaner streets than I did, and that they had learned that the bullies won't hurt you if you keep them laughing. And so I took on then to learn comedy and music and learn a trade.
Bullying is hard? No, comedy is hard. A response to bullies, comedy. 877-8-MY-TAKE, your story, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Some great suggestions this morning.
Absolutely. Brian. Very deep stuff. Thanks, John. Detroit, Michigan has taken an economic beating, but politics isn't doing so great either.
Everybody knows how the car companies and everything's going to crap right now. And I don't think that just this new mayor is going to be able to fix everything. But I think just right now, if we had somebody that had the respect of the people, would be a great start for the city of Detroit.
This morning, Detroiters head to the polls to replace their ousted and convicted mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick. Noah Ovshinsky is a political reporter for WDET, where you can listen to The Takeaway every morning. Now, Noah, I want to look at the candidates. This is retired Pistons player and businessman Dave Bing.
If you think Detroit has gotten better over the last 10 or 12 years, and you're satisfied the direction that this city is going, then I'm probably not your guy. If you want change, positive change, that's something that I think I will bring to the table.
So, Noah, tell us a little bit about Bing and his constituency.
Yeah, Dave Bing, as you said, is a former Pistons All-Star, well-known businessman here in Detroit. He owns an auto parts business. And actually, up until the election, he lived in a posh neighborhood, a suburb of Detroit. Only when the election rolled around did he get a place in Detroit. So he's a relatively new resident, but he's a longtime business owner here in Detroit and, of course, has a lot of fans from his days as a Detroit Piston.
You know, is there a specific demographic that is going for him or looking at him?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little unclear as far as demographics, but certainly those voters who are, you know, disillusioned with the political process in Detroit will be looking seriously at him, only because he's a political novice. I mean, he's never run for an elected position before, certainly here in Detroit. So he's in that sense, he's almost a new face. And I think for those looking for real change, as he said, I think he's their pick.
Here's a little bit from Mayor Kenneth Cockrell, Jr.
And I'm not ripping on him because I kind of, at a certain point in my administration, adopted a policy of saying, I'm not going to keep dumping on Kwame Kilpatrick because whatever problems he left behind, at this point, they're my problems.
Yeah, his problems. So how is the mayor faring in this race?
Yeah, you know, unlike Dave Bing, he's had to essentially the last 7 months has been an audition, essentially, for the mayor's job. He's been in that position as an interim mayor. And, you know, I think the results are mixed at this point. You know, he has been a longtime part of city government, both in the city council and the Wayne County Commission. So he is a known commodity.
But in this particular case, Noah, incumbency does not help Mayor Cockrell, right?
Well, you know, he's only been mayor for 7 months. He inherited a very large deficit, something in excess of $300 million. So the financial position in the city isn't that great. And he's really spent the last several months trying to stop the financial hemorrhaging. So a lot of it has been damage control. I don't think he's had a lot of opportunity to really display what he can do differently for the city, because right now it's just damage control.
You know, I was struck that Arne Duncan, the education secretary, kind of admonished Detroiters, saying, look, you better vote in this election. And, you know, I want to play a little bit from a Detroit resident, Michael Maxwell.
You know, it's corruption all through the system, so it doesn't matter who gets in or who's elected. We're still in some type of republic, and it's crazy. So, I mean, it doesn't matter to me who gets elected or who doesn't. It's still the same. I have to survive regardless, so it doesn't matter.
So that's a completely kind of beaten down take on this. Cynical, you know, it's tough to be positive in this case. But What about, do folks like Duncan have a right to criticize the turnout in an election like this?
Yeah, I mean, election officials are talking turnout somewhere around 15% today, which is around the same number of people that showed up for the February primary, the special primary, where there were 15 candidates on the ballot. So they don't expect turnout to change all that much. Whether or not people, outsiders, have a right to criticize it, I don't know. But certainly the cynicism that was displayed in that soundbite right there is certainly widespread. Between the Kwame Kilpatrick controversy, which consumed this city for more than a year, and also the various federal investigations that are going on now in city government here in Detroit, between those two things, as well as the general economic state of Detroit and Southeast Michigan, I think it's all come together to create this sort of perfect storm of cynicism, apathy, and frankly, voter burnout.
Just quickly, is there any light at, you know, ahead that people are looking forward to, whether it's economic or political in Detroit?
Yeah, I mean, Ken Cockrell Jr., our current mayor, has gone out of his way to point out his green credentials throughout the campaign. When they're not criticizing each other personally, Cockrell has spent a lot of time talking about his effort to bring green technology and firms to the city. So that's looking towards the future, but the situation, the revenue picture is not looking good for the city. Now there is some monies coming in through the federal stimulus fund, but again, that's really only temporary.
Right.
So it remains to be seen. And again, Dave Bing is betting that more voters, want change than those that, want the status quo, so to speak.
Well, thanks so much. We were speaking to Noah Ovshinsky, reporter for WDET in Detroit. Now we have Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. H1N1 or swine flu cases are rising in the U.S. National and state labs count nearly 400 confirmed cases in 36 states. But the American death toll remains at only one, and that was a toddler from Mexico. Scientists say the rising number of cases is more because of new test results rather than a stronger virus. And in fact, the Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano says that swine flu cases in the U.S. have been rather mild.
We are cautiously optimistic that this particular strain will not be more severe than a normal seasonal flu outbreak.
The Centers for Disease Control says the disease doesn't appear to be as deadly as they feared, but they're still asking Americans to be careful. China apparently isn't taking any chances with U.S. travelers, though. It's tightening up visa rules for American visitors. Now China will require 6 days to process visa applications, and American citizens could previously get visas, in as little as 1 day. That's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Good morning.
And I'm Farai Chidea. We are thinking about bullying today because a new study says bullying victims are more likely to develop psychotic symptoms as teens. You can find out more at our website, thetakeaway.org, but we need your advice. What is the best way to stand up to a bully? On our website, Emily writes, "My father attended 14 schools growing up." Wow. "And each time he faced the bully of a new school, he fought them like a wildcat every time, giving them much more trouble than they bargained for. My father taught me that bullies are essentially cowards and more interested in dominating than having an actual fight." Yet another great story. We've had so many. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Not too late. Email mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
So New York Times ethicist joins us now to react to something Barack Obama said in response to the escalating swine flu story. Last Wednesday, of course, we were all concerned that swine flu was spreading around the world.
"Keep your hands washed. Cover your mouth when you cough. Stay home from work if you're sick, and keep your children home from school if they're sick.
Now, this week, the swine flu is still an issue, but we're not as concerned as we were last Wednesday when Barack Obama said that during a news conference. Randy Cohen, ethicist and columnist at the New York Times Magazine and the man behind the new Moral of the Story blog at NewYorkTimes.com, NYTimes.com. So, Randy, have you washed your hands this morning?
I have, John. I'm wearing my protective rubber suit, but I still washed anyway.
That's great, protective rubber suit. We'd love to put a picture of that on our website. Randy, can you help us out there?
As long as you don't put my head on the body of an animal, you can post whatever you want.
Excellent. And ethically speaking, what is the requirement to change your behavior, your travel plans, work schedule to accommodate this notion that we all need to prevent the spread of flu?
Anytime your actions might do harm to another person, you have an ethical obligation to act. And so if you have reason to believe you're going to infect others, you do have to stay home from work or school or stay off trains.
So coughing without covering your mouth, that's an easy one, right?
Right. You should cough and cover your mouth. In fact, I'm coughing all I can.
And the washing your hands and making sure that, when you leave the restroom, that sort of thing, that's a really easy one.
Yeah, and the nice thing about that one is you both benefit others because you're less likely to pass an infectious disease or this infectious disease on to them, and you benefit yourself because you're less likely to contract the disease.
Randy, I really love your column, but I have to do a reality check.
I heard that but. Oh, the but.
Yes, the but. The reality check on people staying home from work when they're sick is sometimes people will fire you. It may not be legal, but,
Well, you'd love my column even more if you'd start reading what I write, because I did note that in the column that if, as a community, we expect people to act in these virtuous ways, we have to make it possible. And you're quite right. Many people will be fired if they stay home from work, or they'll lose pay, especially low-wage workers who very much can't afford that.
So what do you do?
Guarantee paid sick days to people. If you do not, you cannot expect them to act in this way.
So it's only moral to stay home, it's only immoral to go to work if you have a paid sick day that you could be taking advantage of.
While you still have an ethical obligation to do this, that's what ethics dictates. But if the question is, well, how do we get people to behave virtuously? How do you get people to do the right thing? That's very much a community obligation. People won't do it unless you make it possible. But if you do, it's amazing how well people will respond.
You know, Randy, I think you were bullying my co-host Fry there for a moment. I don't know what you thought, but
you left something out, and I didn't. That's not bullying. That's correcting, Jeff.
I think it's fair.
Let's take a more complicated one. And Fry and I were talking about this earlier this morning. What about vaccinations? If you have a problem with the idea of vaccinating your child, even though society might dictate that keeping people from getting diseases that might result in infecting, say, pregnant mothers with measles, which could result in birth defects, what is your obligation to get your children vaccinated, independent of the law?
The medical evidence for vaccination is so overwhelmingly in favor of it that I believe you have a moral obligation to do it, and that when it comes time to making decisions that very much rely on profound, detailed professional knowledge, some deference is necessary to medical professionals. It's not that they're always right, but they're right a lot more than the internet is right. So that I believe you have an obligation to get your children vaccinated so they don't harm others. The other piece of this is if you believe that vaccination is in fact dangerous, then you're a parasite. Then you are protecting your children through herd immunity by having other kids take the risk. Either way, you're wrong. You're morally wrong.
Here's the hardest one, though. If you have relatives coming over and you may, for like a family dinner or something, and you may have reason to believe that Aunt Mabel is coughing up a storm, but she's going to come anyway because she just loves to see those kids, how do you tell her to stay home?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's socially often very, very awkward to get people to do the right thing. That's why I just turn off all the lights and lock the doors and pretend I'm not home. I mean, you're right.
That's not going to work.
It's an impossible situation. If you're the people you close to you are unwilling to do the right thing, it can be very, very awkward to do it. I'm not the man.
Help us through the awkward, okay? I'm Aunt Mabel, all right? You're Randy. What do you say?
If you have young children, you can always use your children as an excuse.
I'm Aunt Mabel.
Oh, you're Aunt Mabel?
Call me up.
What are you wearing, Aunt Mabel?
Randy, you're always going there, and it's really troublesome for me. We want to stay on the air.
Well, you're an attractive man, John.
All right.
You have to be firm. You have to be firm and gentle. You have to tell Aunt Mabel that I love you. We're always delighted to see you, but we're very concerned about the kids coming down with the flu. You sound a little sick. Let's have a visit next Thursday.
Okay.
But not today.
Could you say the same thing if your kids weren't a crutch, if there were no kids and you still didn't want to get infected?
That's why you have children. They're the social excuse for all occasions.
Tough stuff. Good advice from Randy Cohen, ethicist and columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of the new Moral of the Story blog, which comes out every Tuesday. It's at nytimes.com/ethicist. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Thank you very much. 21 minutes to the top of the hour almost. Pakistan expects some 500,000 people to flee fighting between the military and Taliban fighters in the troubled Swat Valley. The area was supposedly calmed down after a peace deal, but Pakistan introduced Islamic law in the agreement, and Taliban fighters were supposed to disarm in return, but this hasn't happened, and now fighting is set to get much fiercer. The country of Georgia says that Russia is behind a military coup. Russia disputes this. The Georgian government says that plotters plan to kill the president and take over the country. Troops near the capital mutiny today, but the government says they now have the area under control. Israeli President Shimon Peres meets with President Obama today. The most powerful post in Israel's political system is held by the prime minister. The new man in that job is Benjamin Netanyahu. He doesn't meet with President Obama until later this month. And finally, the American cargo captain rescued from pirate custody testifies on Capitol Hill today. Maersk Alabama captain Richard Phillips will take questions at a Senate hearing on combating piracy. U.S. Navy Special Forces rescued Phillips after pirates held him hostage for 5 days. That's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I am Farai Chidea. The government in one of the world's youngest democracies collapsed yesterday when the prime minister of Nepal resigned. That ended the rule by former Maoist guerrillas who took power in elections last year after fighting a 10-year-long civil war against the Nepali monarchy. Protests from all sides have exploded in the capital city, Kathmandu, in recent days. And now we've got Samini Sengupta covering the story for our partner, The New York Times, where she's the South Asia bureau chief. Hi, Samini.
Hi, Farai.
So there's been this 10-year insurgency, but really, what is the key to this since they had a relatively peaceful transfer of power?
Nepal is a small country with epic drama. For 10 years, the Maoists waged war against what was the last Himalayan kingdom. 2 years ago, you had a historic ceasefire. Then last year you had elections with the Maoists getting the largest number of seats. They led a coalition government, and there was a lot of unfinished business, namely what's going to happen to the Maoist fighters. The Maoists wanted them to be integrated, all of them to be integrated into the army. The army resisted that. The Maoist prime minister, Prachanda Pushpa Kamal Dahal, he tried to sack the army chief. Others in the government resisted that, and yesterday he stepped down, plunging the country into a new phase of political uncertainty.
Now, Nepal's a small country, and it's between two giant powers, China and India. So what is the relationship of this country to those countries, and are those countries trying to influence the outcome?
That's a very good question. India has long considered itself a very close ally of Nepal. Nepalis, it must be said, often resent what they consider a disproportionate influence of India over its policies. India is very much vested in having a stable Nepal. It's got lots of unstable neighbors at the moment, including Pakistan and Sri Lanka, and so it really needs Nepal to work. At the same time, you can see China exercising greater and greater influence in Nepal, as it is exercising greater influence in many of India's neighbors. So you've got a bit of a tussle, but really this is a story of Nepal, and it's a story that Nepal's politicians will have to sort out in the coming days.
Just quickly, how are people faring there economically and in other ways besides governmentally and politically?
Nepal is a very poor country. It's long been dependent on aid and remittances of Nepali workers abroad. The latter is of course, under some considerable threat now, right now, as the global economy is in crisis. Nepal has been under 16-hour power cuts every day. There's a very serious problem of joblessness, of just general poverty. And now, with the Maoists threatening more street protests over this, there is continued instability expected there.
Well, Samini Sengupta, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Samini Sengupta is the South Asia Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Go to our website. Check out an interesting story we have about the psychotic or psychological impacts and implications for teens of being bullied as a child. And it motivated us to ask for your advice. What's the best way to stand up to a bully?
I remember my mom once told me to pity bullies rather than hate them, because more than likely they came from broken or abusive home situations. And I did my own investigation and found out that she was right. Once you have that perspective, you can find the compassion to actually try to be a friend to a bully.
Tell us your bully investigations, won't you, at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Great stories from all of you out there. Femi Okeh has some headlines now.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The number of cases of H1N1 are rising in the United States. Federal and state labs have confirmed about 380 cases. However, the CDC says the disease may not be as deadly as feared and is reconsidering advice about closing schools. The CDC says it may not be worth the toll on students and families because it's not effective in stopping the virus's spread. In Mexico, most businesses are reopening today. Universities and high schools will start up again on Thursday. Cafes, museums and libraries are to reopen later this week. However, most major Cinco de Mayo celebrations are still cancelled, including the biggest one of all, a reenactment of the 1862 victory over French troops in the central state of Puebla. The New York Times Company and its largest union say that they will be back at the negotiating table soon to negotiate the fate of the Boston Globe newspaper. The Times Company owns the paper along with our partner, the New York Times, and the Boston Globe State House Bureau Chief Frank Phillips says he's hoping for the best.
It's a very perilous journey to the web, as we can see by this threat to shut down. I want to keep going. I love journalism. I don't want to leave it.
The Times Company is now backing off a threat it made yesterday to file a notice to shut down the paper. And finally, we go to the theatre for this year's Tony nominations.
We weren't born to stand still and a question.
That's the song Born to Boogie from the stage version of the musical Billy Elliot. It has been nominated for Best Musical alongside Next to Normal, Rock of Ages and Shrek the Musical. June the 7th at the Radio City Music Hall in New York City. That's when we will find out who has this year's Tonys. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. So let's be clear, it's not cold swine flu anymore. You heard Femi there. Technically, it's H1N1 influenza A, and you can't get it from eating pork. Nonetheless, for a whole variety of reasons, pigs have a problem. Sure, they're adorable in pictures, but up close, they're disgusting. And some religions even ban pork as unclean. We'd like to discuss the challenges of making pigs and pork attractive. The other white meat, for example, that euphemism was made up by the National Pork Board. And what about this song? Beer Grilled Chops. No, that's not AC/DC. That's a song from the National Pork Board, attempting to upgrade the image of pigs in an environment where, in fact, pigs have a problem. Cindy Gallup is here, advertising consultant and former chairman of the ad agency BBH. Her new project is If We Ran the World, a startup that will use crowdsourcing to match people who want to do good with local projects. Welcome back to the program, Cindy.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Pigs have always had a problem. The other white meat attempts to address the issue, but now you got swine flu. As an advertiser, how do you begin to think about the branding issues for pork?
Well, I think the important thing is to say that rebranding per se is not the answer, because in an unfortunately apposite saying, if you put lipstick on a pig, it's still a pig.
We've heard that.
I love that.
So the answer really, I think, is to make people think completely differently about pork and therefore feel differently about pork. And in the first instance, you really want to try and get people to do that job for you. So I would recommend beginning by getting your most passionate proponents to actually help you with that task, because for people who weren't particularly keen on pork to begin with, it's very easy to get militant about not eating something that you weren't planning to eat.
So in a sense, the issue is a little easier if you focus on bacon and maybe leave the pork out of it.
Absolutely. I have to say that the three most depressing words in the world are life without bacon.
Listen to her.
Well, now, you know, you have the kosher baconaise and all that, because even people who can't eat bacon want to eat bacon. So they just have bacon-flavored products. You know, in some countries, pork is, you know, my sister, who has been a vegetarian at certain points in her life, was in Spain, and she was like, I couldn't find anything but cheese and pork. It was like ham, ham, more ham, and more ham. America has a different relationship to the meat, but how do you think the meat in general fares in the States in the cuisine?
Well, I think actually that currently pork is obviously one of a number of different choices right. That you can make, which is why the other white meat. I think what the pork industry should be doing now is making people really feel passionately about the idea of pork and what would happen if pork were taken away by the people who are getting militant about it. And by the way, this is also obviously a global issue which could be addressed in the same way. So, you know, one of the starting points I'd advocate is finding the people who are passionate about particular aspects of pork. Bacon is a great one for us.
Right.
You know, elsewhere in the world, you know, to your point in Spain or Europe, it's charcuterie generally. In China, many, many pork dishes. And to get the people who are absolutely passionate about pork to start a groundswell movement, a grassroots movement, to go protect our pork.
Have you ever met anyone who's passionate about pig brains?
Do you know?
I haven't myself.
I'm a big fan of brains, but then I'm a big fan of offal, and I'm quite unusual.
I see. Does pork have a problem in the sense that it's an uphill battle even when you begin? Excuse me for a second. And what if the swine flu was not the swine flu, but was the sugar flu or the chocolate flu? Would it be as serious a problem to try to, turn it around?
Well, it absolutely wouldn't be, because if you were to say to people, oh, my God, chocolate is bad for you, don't eat it. You would encounter huge resistance because people love chocolate. So if the chocolate industry were to be countering a similar scenario, they would have a much easier task on their hands. I mean, for example, you know, the sheer joy and happiness that chocolate brings to many of us, just the depiction of a world without chocolate and, you know, something around the thought of, you know, you don't live longer if you stop eating chocolate, it just feels that way, would really speak to people very, very easily.
So in the past, who's done this really, really well? I mean, the horrible case, of course, is Tylenol, which went from being a benign medication to a killer during the Tylenol scare when contaminated Tylenol resulted in cyanide deaths of people who ate packaging that was broken into. How does the Tylenol model help us here? here?
Well, do you know, interestingly, John, I don't think it does, because the fact of the matter is that you cannot contract swine flu from eating pork. I mean, the facts are actually there. The trouble, of course, is that when you are the pork industry saying this, everybody feels you've got a vested interest in protecting your own, and so it's a lot harder to believe you. So there isn't a precedent in the sense that the rational facts are there, but people feel very emotional.
So the reaction, the corporate reaction to something like this can actually set you back a bit.
It can potentially, but what I would really recommend to the pork industry is that they take a much more proactive and much more imaginative approach to this issue. So, for example, if I were them, I would literally be tackling this at a global level. I would be uniting with pork industry representation everywhere. And I would do something like hold very quickly World Eat Pork and Live Day.
So
by which I mean
Pig Aid. Like a rock concert or something like that.
I would get representatives of the pork industry in every country in the world to have one day where the entire world comes together and those representatives very publicly eat pork, bring their families, consume pork, show that it's safe, and invite people to join them for free to sample pork.
We are the world. We eat the bacon, right?
Absolutely.
Well, the oddest pork story I heard was a friend who lived in Mombasa and said that there were underground pork restaurants because it's a highly Muslim area, so you never know.
That's another angle you could take. Actually, maximize pork's renegade status. create the Secret Society of Pork Eaters, mobilize an underground movement, pork resistance. And actually, the moment you give something a dangerous contraband feel, it becomes enormously attractive to a lot of people.
Don't be safe. Eat pork.
Absolutely.
Great advice from Cindy Gallup, advertising consultant and former chairman of the ad agency BBH. She's now founder and CEO of IfWeRanTheWorld.com, a startup that will use crowdsourcing to match people who want to do good with local projects. Thanks to you, Cindy.
And we are thinking about bullying because a new study says bullying victims are more likely to develop psychotic symptoms as teens. You can find out more at our website, thetakeaway.org. We're thinking kids need your advice. So what is the best way to stand up to a bully? Maybe you have your own story to share when you or your child did that.
This is Beth from Massachusetts, and I have a story from my mom teaching high school in New York. She's about 5'4", and she had a student that was over 6 feet tall, a big kid, who threatened to hit her one day. And she just looked at him and said, "What's that going to prove? Everybody knows you're bigger than me and can hurt me." He didn't expect to hear that, and he ended up just storming out of the classroom. And I think that's one good way to get him, is just to throw something at him verbally that they didn't expect.
You can go for more stories to our podcast to go. Go to thetakeaway.org or iTunes. And, it's been an incredible journey to hear people's stories. People have really responded to this, John.
Too many people are being bullied in the world. We have to do something about that. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.